Change.
We need to change things up.
It's a show about change.
Welcome to Bob's Basement. Here's your host, Bob Ouellette.
Welcome to Bob's Basement, and joining me from Calgary, Alberta, Canada, in my basement virtually today is Lori Gibbs. Lori, how are you today?
Well, I'm really honored to be in your basement, Bob. It looks a lot like the guest room in my house in Calgary, so I guess we just have the same taste.
It's true. I love the purple, the mauve, if you will, in your room there. It's very nice. Lori Gibbs, if you don't know who Lori Gibbs is, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm a bad host that way. Sometimes I get so excited, I just want to say things. Lori Gibbs and I met 2 years ago. This very week, actually.
And yes.
Yeah, two years ago this very week. And I'll explain that. But if you don't know who Lori Gibbs is, shame on you. Lori Gibbs is a stand-up comedian, motivational speaker, radio personality, television personality. And honestly, I only spent 6 days with her, but one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. So this is going to be a fun episode.
Thank you so much. No pressure at all.
Exactly. So I did want to say, I was working at Bell Media. I was doing a mat leave cover for a couple radio stations, one in Hamilton and one in St. Catharines. And there's this yearly thing that happens, this magical sandals trip that happens a couple times a year, usually once a year for sure, where all these morning show hosts and sometimes their program directors get to go to Sandals for a week and broadcast from there. It's brilliant marketing on Sandals' part, because who doesn't want a trip to Jamaica or wherever? And this is where I met Lori Gibbs, because at the time you were working where?
I was working at 95.9 CHFM in Calgary on the morning show.
Right. And you were there doing the morning show there. And I wanted to point out something you said to me after we got back, because this is when we were Facebook messaging with each other as we were both landing, trying to get home. And you said, I said, I can't wait till our paths cross again. You said to me, I knew right away we were from the same tribe. You were a sparkly part of my week. Thank you. Hugs and smartassery headed your way. And that resonated with me, that the part of the same tribe, because there's people you meet in life and they just kind of move on. And it was, you had an okay time, but I felt like we really had a great time talking to each other. We have a lot of friends in common, and I hold the art of stand-up in such high regard. I really do. What you do, it is just one of my favorite things, and I'm in awe of people who do it. So that message, I just want to let you know here publicly that meant the world to me.
Oh, okay. Get me right in the feelings. First of all, that there's no way that message isn't me, because it says sparkly and smartassery. So yeah, right there. That's definitely me who wrote that. And do you remember a movie maybe from the 80s called, oh no, don't tell me, I've forgotten it already. There's a movie, and maybe I'll think of the name of it before we finish. But
sure.
The concept is that when the world started, we were all part of one tribe. And as the world got bigger and we went off to hunt whatever we hunted and gathered whatever we gathered, mm-hmm. we all, you know, spread out all over the world and continents moved and such. And that feeling that you get when you meet somebody that, oh, wow, there's already a connection here. It's like, oh, that's a person from my original tribe. Oh, wow. We just like floated away somehow. Maybe it was an iceberg. Maybe there was some sort of saber-tooth escape plan. And then you meet them again and go, oh, you must be one of my dudes or my dudettes.
I like that. Deepak Chopra has something like that as well, where it's about something like soul clusters. And you go through life, all the different lives with that. And these people find each other somehow in some way. So that's beautiful. We have a lot of friends in common because of the radio thing, obviously, but also a guy like Richard Ryder, who I used to work with, who's a stand-up comedian from the LGBTQ community. Mike Wilmot is my best buddy's older brother. And we bonded over that and a lot of Appleton rum, and it, and I just loved it. And we've been friends on Facebook since then. And I love speaking to stand-up comedians, because I find their view on things is so complex and different. And that's what makes a great stand-up comedian, is you have a different take. Right. And I thought, you know, when you were doing something on your Facebook, kind of an Ask Lori thing, and you were like, ask me anything. You did an AMA like they, as they would on Reddit. And you said, ask me. And I said, will you do my podcast early next year? And you said, absolutely. Of course. You ruined your question. So now I get to ask you lots of questions.
That's what I do when I, when I'm craving the connection with people that, that really most healthy functioning people are these days, yeah. Is I will find a way. I will find a way to connect. And if it means ask me anything, like I will talk to you from anything to plumbing, to podcasts, to what kind of shingles I should need for my house. You know, everything is interesting.
I saw that you have a side gig, or had a side gig at least, but with crafting, and so you like many facets to your life. I guess we'll, now that we've kind of set the stage of how we know each other, I will probably, most of the people who listen to my podcast are off, I think, are radio or broadcast people or fans in the Ontario area, because that's where I've done most of my stuff, going all the way back to CFNY and The Edge and Proud FM. And so I kind of wanted to talk to you. Are you're from Alberta originally?
No, actually, I was born in a little place you may have heard of called Vancouver, British Columbia.
Yeah, I've heard of it. I got a really bad hockey team. That's all.
I don't know. I don't know nothing about no hockey. I'm happy if it's a good part of your life, but I so don't care.
Fair enough.
And then when I was 19, I decided to move to Calgary because I was not aware of the fortunate circumstances of living next to the mountains and the ocean in what some people consider one of the most beautiful cities in the world. But there was a boy in Calgary who I had a crush on from, yes, basketball camp. So I kind of had to move here with $300 and nothing. And I guess it stuck because that was in 1985.
And you've been there since. I hope you have more than $300 in your pocket now. Whatever happened to that boy?
That boy is a very well-respected psychologist and author. Oh, wow. And does studies into depression. And I'm like, remember me? I've got so much for you right here, dude.
That's funny.
But you know what's so funny though, Bob? I haven't told anyone this. When I was on the radio, we were doing a bit about old time crushes. And I had had such a crush on this boy, obviously. And I got in touch with them and wrote to him and said, listen, we're doing this bit. It would be really, really funny if you would come on the air and we could discuss like our silly shenanigans at Baptist camp. And he never wrote back. But it's so, yeah, okay.
Doesn't want anything to do with it.
This guy is like a really reputable professional, and it's probably wasn't like great for his image or his trust levels to talk to this this sinner from Baptist camp.
So going to Baptist camp as a teenager indicates to me that you probably came from a bit of a religious household. Is that?
No, isn't that the most fun thing? Oh. What happened was, Bob, it was grade 8. I was 13. And this nice girl named Janice Moffitt asked me to come to youth group one night.
Okay.
And I was like, I don't know what youth group is, but I'm a youth and I like groups. So let's go.
Yeah.
And then I found out that it was at Trinity Baptist Church at 49th and Granville in Vancouver, which was 2 blocks from my house. Hello. And one thing led to another. And then it was just me and Jesus and Baptist camp.
Did any of that? Janice Moffitt. Yeah, of course. Yeah. And eventually the guy who you followed to Calgary. So what did your parents think? Like, were your parents weirded out to have a kid, to be not religious and then have a kid going to all these religious meetings?
I think they thought it was interesting and also borderline hilarious.
Yeah.
Because my mom will still tell me, like, between giggles, when, like, if my older brother was teasing me or something, I said to her one day, that's okay. I'll just turn the other cheek. And she had the same reaction you did.
That's great. You forget how much that stuff rubs off on young ones, though. My kids go to Catholic school purely out of convenience, not anything else, because I am a, you know, I've, as you know, I ran Proud FM. I am a staunch ally of the LGBTQ community and some of the stuff with the Catholic Church has with that community and just, you know, in general. But I'm going at it more from a standpoint of the individual teachers don't necessarily feel that way. But my 6-year-old comes home with things like, you know, basically saying, well, daddy, we don't want to be sinners. I'm like, oh, right. Okay. Calm down. You know, I'm like, if I'm speeding, my daughter's calling me a sinner, you know?
She's getting you on like the low level. Yeah.
No, everything, everything. So were your parents funny? Do you think that
yeah.
Come from a funny household?
Yeah, I didn't know it at the time because that was just my house. But yeah. My mom, she's hilarious and like very, very quick. And she's 86 now. And there's no way that you would ever guess that. Like I post pictures and they're like, just stop your blatant lying. She's not 86. Like she is. And she should be super proud of that because we can riff back and forth like a storm. And her last relationship, the man, unfortunately he passed away last year, but he said, I've never seen anything like this between a mother and a daughter. This is weird. And it's probably exhausting to be around the two of us at once. I totally get that. But it's that playing that yeah. I thrive on, as you do too, being a talker.
Yeah.
So she was hilarious. And then I had three dads altogether. The one that I grew up with was Angus, my stepdad. And he was very funny too, but in more of a slapstick in your face humor, where my mom was more dry and sarcastic. And then they also just like steeped me in what I found out later was fantastic comedy TV. So All in the Family, MASH, like Hawkeye, Alan Alda was my first crush on a real grown up man because yeah. he was so irreverent, so funny, so sarcastic, but he was also the best surgeon. And I was like, ooh, smart and funny. I think I know what I like.
Have you gone back and watched them now that they're on Disney Plus?
I haven't because I don't want to buy Disney Plus because I'll forget I have it and not use it. Like all the other fair, that's fair the reality enough. Of it, right? Like I think yeah. I have Crave, but it's like probably because I bought it for one show.
I have it right here on DVD. I'm a huge MASH fan.
Stop it. Okay, give a girl a warning, Bob.
Sorry, I'm a huge MASH fan. So I could do a podcast about MASH. Like my dad introduced it to me when I was, and it was, you know, it ended in 82. I was only 6 in 82. I hated it when I was 6 years old. My dad would watch it and I didn't get it. It wasn't until later in syndication and I started watching it and my dad kind of explained to me why it was so important and why it was so funny. I mean, I think you're right. I think it helped shape my sense of humor as well. I can totally relate to that.
Well, and the fact that they're in a war zone and you realize how that humor wasn't just for laughs. That humor was to show that that's how they survived.
Yeah.
And how much can we relate to that, right? Like, I'm not saying we're in a war, but we're in an unprecedented time.
Aren't we, though? In an abundance of caution, blah, blah, blah.
Totally.
I totally get that, you know, and that golden age of television you mentioned, All in the Family, MASH, and of course, you know, would have been Happy Days and Gary Marshall shows, you know, they were so great. So that helped shape you. Let me just, what did you want to be when you grew up, when you were a kid watching all this?
I think when I was about 5, I wanted to be a nurse because I knew that I liked helping people feel better. And then I wanted to be a teacher. And I still think I do. Actually, now that I'm in my 50s, I was reading the other day that in your quote, second half of life, hoping it's another 50, right?
Right, of course. Yeah, no, I know. That's you're middle age. I'm 40. I'll be 46 next week. People like you're middle age. Yeah, middle age. Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm going to live 92. Come on. Let's be honest here. It's past middle age. Come on. Anyway, go ahead.
So maybe they just said, so they should say something like, later at a certain age in life.
Yeah, exactly.
You become curious about everything. And that's exactly what's happening to me right now. Like, I want to be in school, but I also want to teach people things that I know that I can see from a perspective as an older person with experiences might be useful to someone. And I think I'm pretty good at selling it in a way. So it's not like, Bob, this is your problem, and here is my lecture on how you can solve it. But it's done with warmth and love and humor always, because I figure when a person is relaxed and even to the point where they can laugh, their brain is so much more receptive to what you're telling them than if they're feeling anxious or lectured to or intimidated. So that's still the teacher thing. I suppose in a way you could say stand-up does that. I mean,
I think so. I think you're right. When you were 19 and you leave Vancouver, I'm just to focus on the change aspect of things. You leave Vancouver to go with a boy to Calgary. Were you a student at that time? Were you working? Like, what was that change like?
Oh, that was, I think a year. No, wait, I graduated when I was 17 in 83. So that was 85. It was in September. And the boy was already in Calgary living with his family. And he didn't know that he was supposed to spend his entire life with me and we would live happily ever after. Did I forget that very important detail?
Silly boy.
Look at me now. So I went out there and his family said, you can stay with us till you find a place. Now, I had finished high school. I was really good at piano. I was teaching piano lessons at that point because I got my grade 10 Royal Conservatory when I was 16. And then I taught for 3 years before I moved. And then, so what I had was a very good typing speed because of piano. So I was about to take a job as a grill cook at Wendy's on McLeod Trail.
Okay.
And a friend of mine said, why don't you go to a temp agency? And I didn't know what that was. But then I went to the temp agency and I took all their tests. And then I was like the hardest working temp there ever was, man. Yeah. I was pounding the pavement. I didn't have a car. I was taking transit all over the city in a jacket from the Salvation Army because I had no money. And I was just, it was so cool because you went to different kinds of businesses all the time and you had to fit in.
Yeah.
Right.
You had a different relationship with change even then. Like, you know, you change your job every day.
Yes. And I think, like, I mean, if it has to be said, the key to life is recognizing that change is inevitable and always. So why not invest a whole bunch of time getting really good at it?
Absolutely. It sounds like you did. When did stand up enter your life? You'd said you didn't really realize you were surrounded by funny TV and funny people until later. When did comedy come into your life?
The want to try it professionally came in when I was about 20.
Okay.
Because I was always the funny one at the job or whatever. And then I decided that 20 years was a good amount of time to be scared of it. So when I was 40.
Oh no, you sat on it for 20 years.
I sat on it for 20 years and also, like, you know, did regular jobs and became an independent woman and learned lots of things and had lots of great experiences. But on my 40th birthday, a friend posed a question to me about stand-up and said, would you regret it if you were on your deathbed that you'd never tried it? And then I swore at him and I said, now I have to try it, you bleep, 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 bleep.
You can swear on a podcast, by the way, if you really want to.
I'm trying to keep it PG-13 just in case. Fuck! So I had no argument for that. And I'm so glad that that person said that to me, because then I was presented with an opportunity to, I didn't go to church or anything, but my girlfriend did. And she said, hey, we're doing a woman's healing retreat in this small town in Alberta where Kurt Browning's from. And they want to do a healing through laughter piece. Would you like to try your stand-up for that? And I remember thinking consciously, say yes before you say no. Just say yes. So I was like, yes. And then that's how it got started. I was terrified.
So that was your first set? Was that a healing retreat?
A Ladies United Church healing retreat in Caroline, Alberta.
Do you remember any of the jokes you told or any of the stories you told?
Yes, because when I said yes to it, I immediately came home and with my very limber fingers, I typed 11 pages of what I thought was material. right? Now, when you don't know what you're doing, you don't understand that material might start as 11 pages. And if you're lucky, it gets down to a minute and a half of gold comedy. But I just told all these stories. And the beauty was that they knew it was my first time and they were going to be kind.
Wow.
So it was sort of a really good aligning of everything. So even though I was absolutely terrified, I knew that I wasn't, you know, at a bar in Fort McMurray and somebody was going to throw a beer bottle at me.
Right. It was a safe spot.
It was fairly safe. Even though I was so scared, I was crying before I went up in front of them. But then by the time I was done, I was crying because I'd finally done the thing and I knew without a shadow of a doubt.
That was it. You were hooked.
Oh my God. Yes.
It's so funny that your first comedy experience was at a healing retreat, because when I look at all the things on your, all the testimonials about your comedy, and, you know, like somebody once said that you're a human antidepressant, and everybody goes on about the positivity that you bring to the stage and to your work as a motivational speaker. But there's this relationship that I wanted to ask you about. This is serendipitous, but about the relationship between comedy and pain. Like, so much comedy comes from dark, dark places and getting through dark things. How does that end up manifesting itself in this on stage positivity? Like, how does that all square itself in your brain?
Great question. I'll probably be thinking about that when I go to sleep tonight too. It may be too late at that point, Bob.
It was very NPR of me, wasn't it?
No, I love good questions. I was just getting into David Sedaris last night, and he loves weird questions and things that make you think. So I think there's no arguing that everybody will have pain in their life. That is just an inherent part of life. And it's what you do with it that counts. So I guess what comes across in my comedy is that if I'm served a platter of shit, I will find a way to make that funny, at the very least in my personal life, take the lesson from it.
Right.
But when you can take absolute garbage and say, all right, what's the best thing that could come from this? What's the biggest thing I can learn from this? What's hilarious about it? Because I'm one of those people, like, I go out in public and I see something, like, everything has funny to it.
Sure, of course it does.
It's bloody exhausting, but I love it. And so it's like you say, you take comedians will take a thing that most people look at this way, and they'll look at it this way, and they'll throw it in the air, and they'll cover it in glitter and see if they can break it. And until you come up and find that stuff that's in there. And that's what's so relatable. And when you're relatable and people find you real and authentic, they really can't help but lean into it.
Yeah. When I'm watching a comedy show, I'm always interested in how I always think about when I think about the people who are a little bit earlier in the show. Maybe they're newer, maybe they're they're just getting their start. They're not as well, you know, not as polished. You just spoke about your when you knew this is what you're supposed to be doing at, you know, 20 years after you kind of thought it, you should have been what you were doing. I often ask performers, singers, do they remember the moment, you know, when the audience started singing their music back to them, when they started, do you have a moment when you were like, people get me? Like, or where you were on stage and you're like, I am killing it. Like, in your head, you're like, you're having such a good time. And you're like, I actually am good at this. Besides that very, you know, was it an evolution, or is there one memory? What is it?
Well, I think I don't know the answer yet, but I do want to share the feeling I had at the ladies' healing retreat.
Yeah.
Because I've said many times that it felt as if I was settling into a niche, like physically, that my body was just going into this place that it was finally supposed to be. And I'm not sure, I haven't really analyzed this. Maybe it's not even that deep. But before I did the show, bear with me because it won't make any sense.
No, go ahead.
I took a mini pad. And I folded it and I put it inside my bra. So as I'm doing the comedy that I'm more scared of than the two times I gave birth, all of my fight or flight is saying, flight, get the flight out of here. But I'm up there and I'm doing it. And I'm feeling this feeling like, oh my God, is this surfing? What is this? And there was a woman sitting in the back row and she was doubled over laughing, right?
Yeah.
And I said, what is your name? And she said, Pat. And I said, Pat, I have something for you. And I pulled out the mini pad and I said, I hope it's not too late. I hope you haven't peed your pants yet. Then she told me months later through my friend that she has the mini pad because I signed it for her. She has it in her curio cabinet next to her teacups.
That's terrific.
But I think it's cool that there was some part of my brain that said, you know what? You might be really good at this.
Yeah.
Somebody might be peeing their pants. Like that's the healthy amount of ego that gets you to try it.
Yeah, you need that. It's funny. I don't think I've told this story on here, but the whole being on stage thing, and this is why I'm always in awe. I knew I wanted to do performance pretty early on, but I was in ninth grade and I was, I took drama in grade 9 because I knew I wanted to perform somehow. I didn't know what. And my high school did a Grease the musical. And in grade 9, I got cast as Vince Fontaine, the DJ at the party. At the big dance. Like how weird is that? Yeah, 14 years old. Yeah. Good casting by Ms. O'Brien, the drama teacher.
So great.
But I can remember doing the curtain call on the very first night. We had a big theater. Our school had a 450 seat like soft seat theater. And we played 3 nights, sold out, you know, parents and stuff, but we played 3 nights. And I can remember the first night coming up for a curtain call. And because I wasn't just part of I wasn't one of the other grade 9s that were just chorus. I got to come out with the girl who played Cha-Cha de Gregario and we did our own, our own thing. And I can remember going, oh, this is good. I guess like, this is great. And I remember when everybody comes out and we do another, we go together like Rama Lama Lama Ding, and looking over at the kids who were in grade 12 and 13, we had grade 13s then. And going, I'm going to do something like this. Like I know, like this is what I want to do. So I know what you mean by being, having the confidence and that feeling, there's nothing like it being on stage. What is it that now, when you made the change to radio or you added radio, I guess not really change, but how did radio come into your life and how did radio treat you, if you will?
It came in because whenever I would headline the Yuk Yuks in Calgary, this is back in 2013, part of the routine was that you would go to a couple of radio stations yep. and do whatever.
Yep.
Have a couple of bits with them. And I went to X92.9 in Calgary, which was the alternative. It was very, very cool people. And the two guys on the morning show were just a freaking delight, Fraser and Roger. I'm still pals with them now. And so I would come on and we'd have a good laugh. And every now and then they'd say, do you want to stay longer? And I'd be like, yeah what the hell? This is fun, right? We're just riffing. And it was so easy with them because they're both like so different from each other, but both so witty and smart. And then they said, oh, we have this Girl Friday thing. Do you want to come and join the show for the last 2 hours on this Friday? And I guess after I'd done that 3 or 4 times, the boss asked to meet with me. And I was like, okay.
Is that Christian Hall?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So we met at this Starbucks on 4th Street. And I remember saying to him, I go, oh my God, you look exactly like your picture. Like I was pretending like we were like an online dating. And I'm not sure if he laughed or not. I don't think he did, but I thought it was hilarious. And the rest was history. He's like, we like the chemistry between you guys. Do you want to try it? I had no clue, Bob.
Right.
No clue. But I am thankful because he saw something in my personality that would work on radio. And he knew that I could learn all the other stuff.
Yep.
Right. It's like an old boss of mine might once said, you hire for people's values. You can teach them how to use a computer or a caterpillar or a nail gun, but you can't teach them who they are.
It's a culture thing. There's a term for it when you bring somebody in who maybe they don't know everything, but they're a culture add, right? They add to your workplace. And Christian Hall is really one of the most forward thinking people in my business. He's a really smart guy, and it was really smart of him to bring you in. Sadly, there's not enough people like that right now in the industry for a bunch of reasons. There's a lot of budgetary restrictions and there's a lot of fear in broadcast. It's bad. It's not a good scene right now. I'm very happy to have a job and try to change it from inside, but it's hard right now. It's very hard to make good radio with the limited resources that you have, but I'm glad that it worked out. And so I feel like I'll go back because I feel like I want to talk about that journey to become a headliner, but so I kind of jumped ahead because, you know, I have a vested interest in radio. But you weren't one of those kids that grew up like with the radio underneath your, you know, pillow. Did you listen to the radio as a kid? Was radio part of your life?
I did actually. I mean, I felt that my life was changed that one day when I called LG 73 and I asked them to play Huey Lewis. I want a new drug. And then my voice was on the radio and I was like, oh my God, that was exciting. But I didn't consciously think of being someone who talked on the radio. I just wanted to play and be funny all the time.
Yeah, me too. You know what? It's so funny. I feel like there's a lot of people like that. I used to have a record player and a tape recorder, and I would record interviews with like my comedy albums. I would cut and edit my own. Like I would have George Carlin and I'd be like, and Bill Cosby, you know, before everything, obviously, but I had all these Bill Cosby albums and I would literally be like, hi, this is Bobby Ouellette interviewing Bill Cosby here. And it'd be like, Bill Cosby, how are you today? And I have it all queued up. Good. You know, I have it all queued up and ready to go. So I didn't know I wanted to be on the radio then, but I did want to be on the radio. And I know what you're saying. Performing, when it's in you, it's in you, I think, you know. And I think whether you recognize it or not, whether it takes to your 40 to you're on stage or not, I feel like it's something that's innate, that you can't force it, right? It has to be within you.
No, and it's just like, I will never get tired of human behavior. I'll never get tired of learning. The more I learn, the more I know nothing. I love to, well, as you know, sometimes I do a hashtag talk to strangers, because usually it's when I'm traveling, I'll end up talking to anyone around me and find out the most fascinating things.
Yeah.
Or end up being friends with them 15 years later because we met in the lounge in the Ottawa airport. Like, what? Yeah. But I just think like if those opportunities are all around you to connect, and God knows we're learning that we're wired to connect.
Yes.
Then I want to connect like all the time.
So you go from doing the church retreat weekend. How do you end up on a stage? How do you end up at Yuck Yucks?
Well, once I did that, I was quite sure that HBO was going to be calling within the week.
Of course they were. Yeah, for sure. You and that, you know, you and Dennis Miller and Bill Maher and all the, yeah, they're going to call you right away. Yeah, for sure.
Word gets out. I was in Caroline, BC, home of Kurt Browning. So
hello.
Obviously Twitter is alight with my, so that didn't happen. But what I did do was go to the Yuck Yucks, and I went to amateur night and kind of stalked everybody for a while and sort of got the gist of how it worked. And then I signed up for it. And I remember coming up to the guy the first night I had a spot, the manager, and I go, now you have to understand that when I was in Caroline and I was just yip-yapping away for my first time, I stayed up there for an hour.
I bet you did.
So he says to me, I go, how long do I perform for? He goes, 3 minutes.
3 minutes, not even five.
And I go, 3 minutes. And he goes, yeah. And I go, but I have an hour. And I thought, he must have gone home and fallen off his balcony laughing. This first time amateur going, I have an hour.
A full 60 minutes.
Do you though? Because in reality, it takes a year to get 10 good minutes.
Yeah.
So that good amount of ego to keep you going.
Yeah, for sure. So how did that first 3 minutes go? Do you remember?
Not very well. Not very well. Because I was not performing to women of my own demographic at a church. Street.
Right.
And I went home. The only laughs I remember getting were from my friend Kim, who is still my friend because she laughs at everything.
I like those friends. I got a few of those.
They're the worst ones to try material on, though, because they laugh when you say the word purple, right? They're like, ah, he said it like that. So I have to take, so I remember hearing Kim laugh, but not hearing many other laughs.
Yeah.
But I knew, like, from the first experience, I knew how powerful it was that I needed to do it. So I came home and went, okay, let's open the drawing board and let's start realizing that 3 minutes is enough time to tell a long story.
Right.
And how can you make it so that you get a laugh every 10 or 20 seconds instead? And then I just began the process of learning and teaching. And the best thing to do is just to watch everybody. I mean, I tell every comic that no matter where you are on a show, if you can watch the whole show, please do it.
Yeah.
Because even somebody who's not doing well, you can learn something from.
Oh, for sure. That you can learn what not to do just as quick as you can learn what to do.
Totally. And you get to read the room a little bit before it's your turn if you're lucky.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I just wanted to learn and I loved it so much. Like, I was so excited. I scrapbooked every single gig.
Oh, amazing.
For my first 4 years, I think I scrapbooked every gig. And like, it would be like an amateur night, 5 minute set, and it would be a 2-page full on glitter,
everything. Spread,
scrapbook, you know, available for purchase.
You can do
that's
you can turn it into an NFT now. Turn it into something, you know, just scan it and make it worth something, right?
I know. I'm on it.
Where who are your stand-up kind of heroes? Who do you look to? Who did you look towards?
Oh, just me.
Yeah, just that's it. It's all me. That all, everything that came out on stage in the home of Kurt Browning is what is I do now. It's exact same set. It works. It was perfect then. It's perfect now. It's timeless,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, it's not even like I don't even try. it was so funny. There's a comic named Drew Baim, and he is hilarious. And I remember watching an interview with him, and they said, "Who's your favorite comedian?" And he said, "I am. I think I'm hilarious. I live in my head." Yeah. And I was like, that is the best answer
sure.
I've ever heard. Like, honestly, nobody's giving me more material than me.
Well, if you're taking material from others, especially, yeah.
Right? I'm listening to this garbage going around in my head 24 hours.
It's exhausting in here.
Something better come of this. But comedians that I really, like, love watching, probably because I'm a very positive, silly, goofy person, I also enjoy that in a comic. So like Pete Holmes makes me happy. I'm very much enamored with Eliza Schlesinger. We've been friends since 2008, but she just effing goes for it, and it's smart, and she's not afraid to be who she is. I guess I love watching people who are 100% in it. I know that that's who they are.
Right.
Like, you know, when you watch Steven Tyler sing, like there is nothing else going on. To me, he is 100% in that moment, living it. And you know it because you can feel it.
Yep.
So that's my favorite kind of performer. It could be somebody who does dark one-liners, but if I still get that feeling, I love them.
It's an intangible, isn't it? Like sometimes, you know, like there's people I've been going to Yuck Yucks, like I said, because my buddy Mark, his brother is Mike Wilmot. So I've been going to Yuck Yucks for years in Toronto. I went to the old Bay Street one. I've been to the one at Yonge and Eglinton, the one down, like there's the Yucks is now in Richmond. We used to go all the time. And it's interesting. You can tell when somebody's, I don't want to say they're acting, but they're doing a bit, which is fine. Bits are great. I work in radio. That's what we do is bits, but there's nothing authentic about it. And I think that that's what comedy, and I think that's what good radio is too, is things that are authentic, things that are real. I did want to ask, I was going to fanboy out a little bit about the Eliza connection, because I am a big fan of hers. I think she's wonderful. I like her, exactly her ability to just to not be pretty, you know, in that best way, it's all out there, you know, and I don't mean that in a physical way. I mean that in a in a material way.
Absolutely.
She's one. How did you get to know her through the clubs in Alberta, or were you touring, or like?
Yeah, it was funny. It was a Wednesday night, and at that point, it was Yuck Yuck's amateur night, and I was just going to come and headline it.
Right.
So she was dating a guy in Calgary. So she came up with her friend Jody, and asked if she could do a spot on amateur night, just to get a workout, as she called it later. And so before the show, like, the only time I'd seen her was on Last Comic Standing. And I remember thinking, oh my God, like, there's something wild about this woman. She's just so in charge. I don't know. And the confidence was just oozing. So it was funny because she was dating a guy that used to be on the Calgary Flames. So there were a few Calgary Flames there sitting with her. And so we're in the back, the comics, and all the guys are like, oh my God, it's Jerome McGinley, and it's so-and-so, and it's so-and-so. Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, whatever, that's Eliza Schlesinger. Did you see her on that? And there, somebody was like, well, what are you going to do about it? And I'm like, I'm going to go become her friend. I walked over and I sat next to her in a chair and I stared at her until she could say hi to me. Yeah, I was just like the weirdo I am. And I was like, hi, I'm Lori. And she goes, oh yeah, you're headlining tonight. And I was like, yeah. And I said, thanks for coming and probably making me look bad. Really appreciate that. really looking forward to following you. And I said, I would love to hear what that experience was like, because, you know, what you see on TV is 100 million different iterations of what it is really like. Wrong use of word, but still sounded cool. And so we ended up talking, and when she did her set, and easily so funny. And then I did a set and I told a story about fangirling on somebody that I'd never told before. And she found it so funny because it's a really embarrassing story for me. And then we got to talking. So whenever she would come visit her dude, we would get together, or if she'd come through Calgary, I'd open for her. And she would stay here in the guest room, like my teenage daughter.
Oh, wow.
And now, here we are. How many years is that? 13 years later.
It's amazing.
And she's about to have a baby.
I know. I follow her on Instagram. She is a very voracious grammar. She Instagrams a lot. I follow her quite a bit. She's always doing stories. And her husband now is a chef, I guess. And
Yeah. He is so cool. The last time my mom and I were here, I was like, have you ever seen Eliza's husband? She's like, I don't think so. And I put this picture up and we were both just like,
Andy Cooks.
Wow. Andy Cooks. Exactly.
More than Cooks. Tell me about, so we're talking 13, 15 years doing stand-up, you'd say?
I started in 2006. So whatever that is.
14 years. So 14 years of stand-up. How has your, I ask this of songwriters all the time, and I don't think I've ever asked a stand-up comedian this.
Weirdo.
What's that? I'm just bad at math. What did you say? I wasn't paying attention to what you were saying.
14 and
do you know how hard it is to come up with these really good questions? I can't do math at the same time.
It's good that we both talk for a living.
Yeah. Oh, math is definitely not mine. I always ask this about bands and how they write their material, write songs, and how that's changed. You know, the old adage of like, you have your whole life to write your first album, but you got to write your second album in 12 months in the back of a bus. How's your comedy writing changed over the course of the last 15 years or so?
Oh, holy cow. Well, the healing retreat was very, very successful.
11 pages on a typewriter right away, or you know, like right away.
Which so is, easy.
Yeah.
Yes, so easy. So then I realized that I wanted to have the laughs. So I needed to also have things that would be funny to an 18-year-old guy, right, as well as a 40-year-old woman, as well as a 30-year-old engineer, whatever. And so I think it's different now because I'm more comfortable being who I am now than I was for the first bigger chunk, because I would get quite saucy and quite sexual with a lot of innuendo that I've moved away from now.
Okay.
Just because it's a different stage of life. And like when you stalk stand-up comedy at a club, you know that sex jokes and dick jokes, they're going to get a laugh. And part of it is probably just discomfort from some people. And don't get me wrong, there are some fantastic dick jokes in the world. It's not about them. It's just that it was a way to get an easier laugh. And I didn't think of it as easier. I just wanted the laugh so bad that I would go to the saucy side.
Okay.
And that it worked great. And I enjoyed it. And that's who I was at the time. And now I'm just more about, you know, I do a 5 live video every day, 5 live minutes, which is what I consider my own show. And yeah. Talk about all kinds of things in a way that I want to, that nobody can bug me about, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know what that question was, but I veered off into a field a while ago.
No, not at all. No, I mean, it's about how you come up with your material now. Has it changed? Has the current, I'm not going to say, has the way the world has changed become more, and I don't know your comedy to be anything that would be considered offensive, but you know, there are bits on radio, for instance, you know, we have a guy here in Toronto, John Derringer. Derringer, you know, just celebrated his 5,000th episode. And he was talking on the air about how there's stuff that he did, and he's not a shock jock, but there's stuff that he did literally like 5 years ago, he couldn't do on the air now. Like sensibilities, societal sensibilities have changed. Has societal sensibilities changed how you approach your craft?
Yes. Yes. And I know there's a lot of people who say, oh, if we get so politically correct, there won't be comedy anymore, blah, blah, blah. I don't agree with that. I think there'll be comedy no matter what.
Yeah.
No matter what, if locusts are next and storms and aliens, there's still going to be comedy. We're wired to have that as a coping mechanism. Yeah, there are things that I wouldn't do now because I know better now that a word or a term would hurt somebody. So one of my beliefs in life is that I would never intentionally hurt somebody.
Right.
So whether it's a comedy club or not, and this is dependent on every comedian, I'm not saying this is just me.
Yeah.
I don't want someone to come out for a night of laughter to escape from whatever grossness is happening in their lives, because everyone has pain at one time or another. I don't want them to have to feel on the defensive. On the other hand, there's a line, because I just remembered this, it made me so mad, Bob. I don't get mad much. But I emceed a show, and one of the guys on the show had a joke that had the word rape in it, but it was in the context of a sign in a town in Saskatchewan where it said the land of rape and honey, because that was how you referred to corn, I believe.
Okay.
Okay. So what happens after the show? A person that heard me on the radio emailed me and complained to me that there was a rape joke on the show that I was a part of, and that I should probably lose my job because of that.
That's a stretch.
I'm like, what, how would you even think that I knew what he was going to be saying up there? Like, do you think the MC is in charge of content? Like, do we go over it? Yeah,
can I get your list, please, of jokes? Yeah.
and this was a wordplay joke. It wasn't about the horrific act. So I think that's the point where you go, okay, listen, no, you're the one with the issue here. Okay. But then again, if you're that kind of a person, I don't know what you're doing in a comedy club to begin with. So what I'm saying is I don't have a clear answer, but I try not to hurt anybody.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. I find myself watching old episodes, you know, in the middle of the night, can't sleep, throw on something on Netflix, throw on old Simpsons or old Family Guys or something. Like Family Guy was always on the line and usually over the line. There's certain things about Family Guy I can't watch anymore because it was funny when I was whatever, like 10 years ago, 20 years ago. But now, you know what? We've learned that those are hurtful things. I'll give you an example. Over the holidays, you know, the movie, A Christmas Story with Peter Billingsley, the You'll Shoot Your Eye Out.
Of course.
Yeah. It's a classic movie. I have an 11-year-old and a 6-year-old, and we're showing it to them. There's the scene after the turkey gets done. They're going out for dinner and they go to the Chinese food restaurant.
Yes.
And the guys are singing fa ra 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 as opposed to fa la 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 la. When you're a kid, that was hilarious, right? But you can't, but that's not funny. That shouldn't be funny anymore. Or at the very least, you should know why it was wrong that we were laughing at it. So we had to stop and have a conversation with our children about sensibilities. And I don't think that that's a bad thing.
No, absolutely not. I mean, if we don't evolve, what's the point, right? But it's, yeah, it's like that saying, when you know better, you do better.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's true.
And
yeah.
And there have been times when I've talked to friends that will be teaching me something like that, say, this is hurtful. And I won't even fully understand the concept because it's very complicated and there's so many layered issues in it and so much to digest that I'll just be like, what I do know is that this isn't cool and this causes harm to you. So even though I don't understand it yet, I just will stop doing it. For that reason alone, that's enough.
Right. As long as it's not that person who totally misconstrues the joke about rape and corn, right? You know, like, but, and that's where the sensibility, the common sense when it comes to sensibilities, I think comes in. And, you know, on your Yuck Yuck's profile, you know, one of the categories you're under is LGBTQ friendly comedians. And that's, and I ran the LGBTQ radio station for 9 years in Toronto. So I know all about, and those sensibilities changed along the way. And I think you're right. I think if somebody comes to you and says that this is hurtful and here's why, even if you don't understand it, just stop it. And then let them, you know, let them explain it to you. When Bryan Adams got, you know, almost got canceled for his statements about the wet markets in China at the beginning of COVID. I don't know if you remember, Bryan Adams went, and I literally asked some people I know who are, and this is the wrong use of the word, who are more informed than me. I was going to say woke, because, but woke gets jokes about that.
Yeah, it gets connotations.
Yeah, it has connotations, but somebody who I know is much more informed than me. I DM'd them and I'm saying, hey, can you tell me why what he said was wrong? Because on the surface, it seems like, guess what? It does seem pretty bad that there's these markets that are what they are. And he's a vegan and I understand animal rights. And she just sent me this page of stuff. And I was like, and she goes, oh, and by the way, a middle-aged white guy asking this question is the greatest thing ever. Like, because most middle-aged white guys, we don't ask those questions, right? But I do. I want to know why it was wrong for him to say that. And I think, but I think it's still, that doesn't mean we don't have comedy anymore because we care about the empathy is like so important in this world, I guess is my talk about going on rants. I'm ranting during your time.
Oh, it's you know, if you want to rant about empathy any day, I will just have a nap while you rant and you wait for my turn, because that is like with our two sons, when I see them now that they're fully cooked, the time when all of my buttons burst and is when I see them showing empathy, yeah, or when I hear them taking the position of the underdog and asking a question about a different perspective and not being afraid to do that for fear that they're going to be judged. Right. Yeah. Like the thing I've been avoiding Twitter lately, because even though, like, I know so many hilarious people on Twitter.
Oh yeah.
But the tweet, it's got like a snarky bent to it. That's just sort of Twitter's reputation. And some of it is brilliant, but some of it is just like, you couldn't ask a question about why that was offensive because Twitter would kill you.
Oh yeah.
And say, how right. dare you? And they would tear you down. And meanwhile, I'm going, yeah, but he's the guy who wanted to learn more. Isn't he the one who's putting in the time and the care? Whereas you're just sitting there going, bad, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad. Never gonna look inside.
There's a reason I DM'd it, right? Like I DM'd the question. I didn't do it publicly.
Yeah.
I told you we'd go an hour and we're rapidly closing in on an hour.
That's fine.
I do want to ask you about your relationship now with radio, because I don't think you're on the air right now. How did you deal with that change? Was that a voluntary change? Us radio people, we don't treat ourselves very well. So how did that go for you?
It wasn't a good place for me anymore. And I knew it deep in my soul.
Okay.
And it was a very, very hard decision to come to, but I did leave.
Okay.
And, it's scary because it was a pandemic. First of all, this was like in late August 2020. So like you said, the first round.
Yeah, whenever, I don't know.
What do we call that now?
Time means nothing right now. Jesus Christ. Time means like, yeah, just, I want to know. Last Wednesday was the first day of homeschooling of this round. And yeah. I have my 6 and 11 year old. We had one, by the end of the first day, I felt like we'd been doing it for four. Like I was like, how many days have we been doing homeschooling? Four days, right? No. Oh, we started this morning. Oh, okay. All right. I'm just going to.
Is that why we're in the same clothes? That's really okay.
This dry January is not going to last. Yeah. This dry January is not going to last, but it has so far. I'm okay right now.
Yeah. You sound okay. And you look okay.
It's January 10th. I haven't had a drink in 10 days. Anyhow, sorry, please. I didn't mean to interrupt. You were getting
in February.
You were getting very personal and I apologize for interrupting.
Oh, but please don't ever conversations go where they want.
No. So the beginning, it's the pandemic August and you just like, you know, it's not for you anymore. Is it like,
Yeah. And I was like, I knew it and it was a very hard decision to make, but I did. And I was like when I'm creative, I wanna call the shots, I guess.
Yep.
And I think after 7 years in radio, and you know, not just one particular place or anything, there's no blame going on.
No.
But you sort of get hired because you're authentic and real and funny. And then they go, oh, we love that. And then they go, here's how we'd like to tweak it. And you're like, oh, but that's me. That's me. Like I had a talent guy once say to me, oh, pretend that you've looked at the personal photos on your co-host's computer. And I was like, no.
A consultant gave you this? Like a radio consultant?
Yes.
Oh, God.
This was the first time I'd met him on a conference call. Oh. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. No, I would never do that. And he goes, why not? And I said, because I would literally never go onto his computer. Oh, and he goes, well, this is like SNL, Lori. You're playing a character. And I'm like, no.
No, actually, this is me. This is what's wrong with my business. You're killing me, Lori. This is the worst thing ever. Guys like that are killing my fucking business. I can't stand it. I get so angry when I hear shit like that. Yeah. Radio stations are using fake callers. They're using and it's all set up and it's not real. Authenticity is the only way we're going to survive. God damn it.
And the funny thing is,
God damn it. I'm sorry you went through that.
Ugh. No. Oh, thank you. But it's just a learning, right? So that pushes me towards, you know, what I do want to do. So yeah. Use it as a lever kind of. But I think I have a pretty good idea. How am I trying to say this? I know what I would like to put on the radio, and that is not the stuff that we were being encouraged to put on the radio.
Yep.
And I think there was a tendency because of the pandemic that radio should be kept ever so light.
Yep.
You know, we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about teddy bears today. Ugh. And we're going to talk about scented candles tomorrow. It's like, no, you know what? Right now, more than ever, we need to talk about the real shit.
Nobody
wanted to do that because I think there's fear behind that.
Because you can talk about the real shit and still be funny.
Exactly.
And still be entertaining and informing and all the things that we're supposed to be.
And you get to be the better things, which are having a connection.
Connect. Yep.
Yeah, empathizing. Yeah. Learning.
Yep.
That's why I feel more true to myself doing this.
That's why we're losing all the good people, right? Like I'm very lucky right now. My boss is allowing me to, you know, we're building a couple, you know, we have a couple radio stations. We've had some turnover. I've got some people coming in and I am really pushing look, everything that radio has, you can get elsewhere now. Right. Except for the personalities. You can get traffic. You can get weather. You can get your music. You can get it everywhere else and a lot faster and easier and on demand. So you better goddamn well bring something unique. And that's the personalities. And it's horrible that it's not at all surprising, but it's horrible that that's one of the things that kind of drove you out of radio. But I totally get it. Also, not so good for stand up because you can't be up late if you're doing more.
There was that. It's like being a baby.
Oh, it's hard.
opposite schedules. Like you stay up till three after stand up because you have adrenaline that you can't get rid of. And then you get in your car and go to work.
Yeah, it's the worst. No, I totally get it. Lori Gibbs, you are hilarious and thoughtful and just a wonderful person. And we could do this for another hour easily, I'm sure.
Oh, easily. And I wish that we were at some sandals.
I know. How much better would this have been?
Oh, but your basement's been great too. Oh,
where? Okay. So let's talk about all the socials. Where do you do your 5 minutes with you? What are all the socials?
Okay. So I do 5 minutes live every day of me. It's like having coffee with me, but I don't let you talk. And it's called Five Live with Gibber, and it's on YouTube and it's on Facebook Live. If you want to find me, it's LoriGibbs. And that's all you need to know. If you like me more than that, you'll find me.
Absolutely. Lori Gibbs, thank you so much.
My pleasure. I just love talking to you.
We got to stop making changes.
This has been Bob's Basement. Thanks for listening.
Things change. That's the way it is.
For more information, email Bob at bobwillette@gmail.com. That's Bob Willette, like Gillette, with a W. Follow Bob on Twitter at Bob Willette. Bob's Basement is available where you find your favorite podcasts. Until next time.
Well, that's the way it is.